Welcome to the Pro Politics Podcast. I'm Zach McCrary. I've been working in politics for the better part of two decades, but at heart, I'm a political junkie who wants to talk to interesting people involved in politics. Today, I'm talking to Carlos Lozada, the New York Times opinion columnist, after nearly 20 years at the Washington Post, many of those as the nonfiction book critic, during which time he won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism in 2019. Carlos is also an author with his new book, The Washington Book, published recently, a collection of his essays of what books written by and about Washington power players tell us about our current political moment and the direction we're headed as a country. It's a really smart book, very readable, makes you a lot smarter about a whole host of things by the time you turn the last page. And this conversation with Carlos is a really fun and wide-ranging discussion with a smart thinker and writer about everything American politics. Carlos Lozada, author of the new book, The Washington Book. How does a kid born in Lima, Peru, graduates high school in Lima, Peru, how does that kid develop and focus in on a passion for and a career among Washington politics?
Very accidentally. First of all, thanks for having me on the show. So the way to start is how I got into journalism, and from that, how I got into kind of Washington journalism. I never thought I would be a journalist. I didn't do student journalism as a high school student or as a college student. I wanted to return to Peru and be a policy wonk. I wanted to work for the finance ministry or the central bank. And I studied economics in college and in graduate school, and I went to work for the Federal Reserve, thinking that that would be really good training for that. And that's when I realized I was doing it wrong. I was bored out of my mind. And I'd always had a very romantic view of journalism, kind of written a little bit like as a hobby for my alumni paper and that my alumni magazine and that sort of thing. I thought, well, maybe I can try to do that. And I parlayed the background I had in economics to get a job at Foreign Policy magazine in DC. And that's where I really learned to be an editor and to think journalistically. And I worked very closely with some terrific editors. It's a classic kind of small Washington magazine deal. So people move in and out, lots of turnover. And if you stick around for a while, you end up doing lots of things. And I stuck around for a while, for about 5 years. From there, I made my way to the Washington Post, initially as the economics editor. So I used this thing I was trying to get away from. I kept using it to sort of, you know, find new jobs. But once at the Post, I developed a real passion for politics beyond just being a sort of cursory consumer of political news. In different editing roles, I just had to read a ton of Washington books, in part just to keep up with the reporters that I was editing who all wrote Washington books. From that, I made my way to being a book critic. And when you're a book critic at the Washington Post focusing on nonfiction, it's all politics, right? And so that's where I started reading a lot more seriously, you know, political memoir, political manifestos, a lot of Washington documents and reports that kind of stayed from my news editing instincts. That's just kind of how it worked out. My first year as a book critic at the Washington Post coincided with the launch of the Trump campaign in 2015. That's how a lot of my experience as a critic has kind of coincided with that political era.
And what books do you look back on, whether it's in the early days of your professional career, maybe as a student, but what books do you look back on that got you on the track of reading, writing about Washington? What were your gateway books into the genre?
Weirdly, one author who has written so much about politics in different contexts, and yet not about Washington at all, going back to my own roots, is the Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa, the Nobel laureate who I started reading as a kid and who I think has informed my political worldview. In a sense, perhaps his greatest book to my mind is Conversation in the Cathedral, which is about Peru experiencing a kind of not quite soft, but a kind of mid-level authoritarian regime in the 1950s, and seeing how it affected people in the business world, it affected university students, how it affected all sorts of classes of society. That got me thinking about politics in a big way. You know, when I became an American citizen, it wasn't until late 2014. So I just missed the midterms to be able to vote. So 2016 was the first election I ever voted in the United States. When I became a U.S. citizen, I decided to read Democracy in America, Tocqueville, which I'd never read. It's such a cliched answer, but I just felt like I had to read it. Like someone in my job had to have read that book. Ended up being sort of after the fact, a kind of touchstone as well.
And what did you take away from the de Tocqueville book, a book that is, I've heard you in other settings use the term often cited, lightly read, probably a good example of that. What did you take away reading it with fresh eyes not that long ago?
A couple of things. One is it really brought home for me the kind of the American obsession with associational life, right? With joining things. And it made me think about the moment when I came to college in the United States at Notre Dame. I felt like I had a choice. Like I had to choose either, am I going to join the Hispanic American Students Organization or am I going to join the International Students Organization? And those two groups were incredibly different. Even though they both had a ton of sort of Spanish speakers, they didn't really get along. They both tried to persuade me that like that's where I belonged. It was interesting to me that you can embrace the whole, right? But then the parts start claiming you. De Tocqueville does a very good job of noting how remarkable it was to him, the degree of kind of joiningness, right? He had more articulate ways to describe it, but how essentially Americans are always joining things, always expecting you to joining things. The drop-down menu is endless, right? There's always new things to kind of use to stake out an identity. So that's one thing that I thought he captured really well. The other that I just thought was funny and it stays with me. When I read these books and the more years go by, the more it's just like one or two things from each book that really, really has that kind of enduring staying power. But the other thing was how he said that, Americans just go insane every presidential election. And it becomes the only thing they can think about, the only thing they can talk about, the only thing they can argue about, just crescendos in this kind of obscene hyper obsession. But then it all goes away, and then everything returns to normal, and everyone calms down. And I think that maybe today that first part is right, that it becomes this all-encompassing obsession. But I'm not all that hopeful for the everything calming down part that is supposed to come afterwards.
And your book is the Washington book. That's certainly largely going to talk about that, but you're a man of the world in a lot of ways. How unique is this to America? Is there a whole category of London books, Ottawa books, Mexico City books, Lima books? I'm maybe exhausting my world capitals at that point, but is this unique? Is this hyper unique to America in your mind? Or are there, even if it's a smaller scale, a sort of a similar genre in many other places in the world?
That's not something I've focused on, sort of Washington and U.S. politics, but I think that there are some both similarities and sharp differences in the kind of political books that become significant in other countries. I think that there's a much greater tendency for sort of novelists and intellectuals to wield political influence through their books in other countries, a little less so, I think, than in the United States. And that's significant. When I think about the great political books in Peru, I don't necessarily think about books by politicians, right? As I mentioned, I think about the sort of canon of Vargas Llosa, for instance. And I think there's a tendency as well in Europe for that to be the case. The sort of obligatory campaign memoir by, every person who's running for office is a bit of an American phenomenon. That's one form of American exceptionalism that may not necessarily be sort of our best foot forward.
We'll go ahead and set the table here, and you've already done it a little bit in terms of your distillation on what exactly is a capital W, capital B Washington book.
Yeah, I try to define that very broadly. Sort of, I take a very expansive definition. Part of it is, books by politicians. That's sort of the innermost of the concentric circles of Washington books. Those are both the anticipatory memoirs by people who hope to, reach high office. It's the kind of revisionist history by politicians once they depart office. Every president is somehow contractually obligated to issue memoirs after the fact, sometimes multiple. Then there's the sort of manifestos by activists and different movements that try to stake out certain kinds of territory. There's the books by journalists, like as I mentioned, so many of my colleagues at previously at the Washington Post and now at the New York Times cover this world and put out a million books about it. Many of them are very good, but there's just so many that it's sort of hard to keep up or even decide what's most important to read. I'm also interested in these are more sort of documents and reports than books, but I love to read commission reports. I love to read special counsel investigation reports, which we have many these days. I think of those absolutely as Washington books, commissions in particular, like, you think about the 9/11 commission or the Kerner Commission report on the urban riots in the 60s. the January 6th committee, special committee report. What's so special about them and why I write quite a bit about them in my book is these are snapshots of America at its most traumatized moments, right? You know, the Kennedy assassination, 9/11, all these moments have their special commissions that explore them. So they're almost like a parallel history of the country and also of a country as it could have been, because they tend to offer lots of recommendations, many of which are ignored. I don't know who on earth would read this, but one thing that I would love to write someday is sort of a history of the United States just through its commission reports from, you know, the very earliest to the very latest. And then finally, there are books that you don't really think of necessarily as being political books, as being Washington books, but that become so because they become part of important or intense, impassioned debates. The 1619 Project, right, is not necessarily a, strictly speaking, Washington book in any traditional sense, but it became part of a big Washington debate. Ibram Kendi's work, a lot of the books on race and identity of recent years have become highly politicized, important kind of markers in our political debates over how we think about race and history, right? And so I think of those also as political books, as Washington books, even if the authors perhaps never intended them as such.
And aside from governmental reports, government documents, thinking of the books you can go to a bookseller and buy, do you have a sense when this genre of Washington books started? I mean, how far do you have to go back to find something that we today would recognize as a Washington book?
You know, there's a book that came out a few years ago called Author in Chief by Craig Fearman, and it looks at the writings of the men who would become president from the very first. To some extent, all our presidents and many of our political figures have always been trying to stamp their version of history on the world in written form. Even if it's a genre that feels like it's exploded in recent decades, one of the very best, and I'm hardly the first to point it out, one of the very best presidential memoirs, for instance, is by Grant. Even though it's not really about his presidency at all, it's about the Civil War and the Mexican-American War, you'd be kind of surprised to realize that that guy became president. You know, like, oh, really? He became president later. He didn't seem to care much for politicians. But, you know, that was shortly before he died. And that's been around for a long, long time. Mark Twain was his editor. I think and this is just a theory that I'm expounding now, maybe I should have to sort of look to see if it holds up. But I think since the political primary process opened up so much more in the 70s, I think you have a case where every unlikely candidate is trying to put out a campaign biography. It's sort of a gamble, I think, by the publishing houses that, you know, one of these people is going to become the nominee or become the president. And so if that happens, then that person's book matters, you know, and in hindsight will be a smart thing to have published. You know, that's how you end up getting books by like Tim Pawlenty.
Nobody's making money off of George Pataki's campaign.
Yeah. But if Pataki had ascended to the highest office, right, then it would be a big deal. Dreams for My Father is sort of the ultimate example of that, right? It's a book that was reviewed politely and kind of came and went when it came out in the 90s and then became a sensation later. So I think it's been around for a long time, but I think it's definitely exploded in recent years. And what's really exploded is the books about politicians, right? Not just the books by politicians, but the books about politicians. During Obama, you had just orders of magnitude greater ink spilled in hardcover than you may have had in other presidents. And then even the Obama record seemed small compared to the explosion of Trump books. You started getting books about very narrow swaths of an administration. I sort of blame Michael Wolff with Fire and Fury. I mean, blame sounds pejorative, but I mean, I think he had significant influence over the kind of Trump books that came out. Suddenly everyone wanted to write that kind of book with the holy crap kind of anecdotes. And, you know, can you believe he said this? I mean, and there were lots of those anecdotes. And so it was just reflecting reality. But certainly I think it's a genre that has exploded. There's no way I wrote a book 4 years ago called What Were We Thinking? Trying to understand the Trump era through the books that it produced. And I read about 150 of them for that book. And even that was just a tiny, tiny fraction of the books I could have read. I could have had, you know, two or three other volumes of entirely different sets of books just looking at that period.
Let me ask about the Grant biography. Is that actually readable to our sensibilities today? Sometimes you hear these old comedians were great. Oh, Lenny Bruce was a great comedian. You go back and listen to Lenny Bruce, not that many laughs to our ears of 2024. So how does the Grant memoir hold up 150 years after the fact?
Yes, one of the expressions that I sort of dislike the most is, that such and such hasn't aged well. But the crazy thing is, so obviously I wasn't around when it first came out, but I didn't even read it until 10 years ago. I thought it held up remarkably well. Even the language just felt very conversational, very approachable. There was humor in it. It felt like I remember speaking to David Marinus, the great presidential biographer, former colleague of mine at the Washington Post. We read it sort of at the same time, and he was struck as well by how it almost could have been written for contemporary audiences. He would do this thing where he would kind of like drop a little story, which was fine on its own, and then hundreds of pages later, he'd have another little story that kind of like tied together just beautifully. Like one that I loved, if we can geek out for a second about Grant's memoir. He went to West Point. He like barely got in. At one point, I think after his first year or one of his first vacations back home, he's all proud of his like cadet uniform and he's like wearing it, walking around town. And suddenly some guy in his town just saw him and started making fun of him for wearing his fancy military duds. And he writes that since then, he developed this distaste for, excessively ornate military uniforms. And that's fine, whatever, little anecdote, you move on. Hundreds of pages later, you're in Appomattox, right? It's the end of the Civil War, and Lee shows up to discuss the terms of surrender. And Lee shows up decked out in like all the fanciest stuff. And Grant just tears into that, about how ridiculous he looked. And he was using a, he was carrying a sword that he would never wield in battle. Suddenly you remember, right? You remember that first story, how he felt about military uniforms. It just tied beautifully chapters and chapters later for that sort of essential moment in American life, which is the end of the Civil War. And like that, it was all over the place. It was just really well written. It felt very honest. I've not read all the presidential memoirs that someone like Fearman did for Author in Chief, but I've read many, and that's certainly one of my two or three favorites still.
Is All the President's Men the most famous, most influential, most widely read Washington book? Is that stating the obvious? What do you put at the top of the list?
Oh, well, I mean, there's so many ways to measure that, right? I mean, famous probably, right? It's probably one of the most famous for sure. Partly the quality of the book itself, partly the moment in which it came, and partly Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman, didn't hurt in expanding that fame. My dad, I remember because I came from Peru twice. I came when I was a little boy, and we lived in California for a few years. Then we went back to Peru until I finished like middle school and high school, and then I came back for college. But in that first time we came, it was the late 70s, mid to late 70s. I remember my father, who did not speak English well, did not read English well either. He would read a lot of novels, but the one nonfiction I remember him reading was All the President's Men. He would underline words he didn't know, and I would sort of like curl up with him and watch him read this book. So yes, I think that in the Washington book pantheon, that holds a very unique place. In part, it's because Watergate holds such a unique hold on American political lore. Garrett Graff recently wrote an excellent book called Watergate: A New History, which he sort of absorbed not only every memoir, every declassified document that has ever come out on Watergate, every interview with every sort of surviving person, and managed to tell just a really fascinating story. Watergate's the sort of the gift that keeps on giving in that sense. I think All the President's Men is up there. But the ones that stick with me aren't necessarily always the ones that are sort of the big sellers or the most famous. One of my favorite books about American politics is this book that came out about a decade ago called The Speechwriter by Barton Swain. And he was a speechwriter to Mark Samford when Mark Samford was governor of South Carolina. The one speech he didn't write was that rambling press conference that Mark Samford gave when he sort of fessed up that he hadn't been hiking the Appalachian Trail, but had been hooking up with his mistress in Argentina. But it was just a wonderful book about political communication, about working for a boss you don't respect, the kind of trials of daily politics. And he had one thing that really stuck with me. He reached a very interesting conclusion about this popular notion that politicians always lie, right? And he says that they actually don't always lie. When they use vague, slippery, or meaningless language, it's not the same as lying, at least not always the same as lying. They're just trying to buy time to preserve options because they're being asked to weigh in on things every day of which they have no knowledge or no interest. But they have to say something, right? And so he says that a lot of what politicians do is just try to sound like they're saying something instead of saying nothing. That always stuck with me. When I listen to politicians speak, I always keep Swaim's admonition in mind. And I think of my job, reading political books, if politics is the art of draining the meaning from words, right, from language, I think of my job as trying to scoop that meaning up and stick it back in. And that's kind of how I try to read political books. Barton Swaim's book helped me articulate that.
It's already come up, these the genre of presidential campaign biographies. You mentioned Tim Pawlenty, George Pataki, those type campaign books, which are, just part of the process now. You hit an Iowa fish fry, launch an exploratory committee, release a campaign book. You've read so many of these over the years, some of which are chronicled in the Washington book. What are some of your favorite tropes, cliches? If there was a presidential campaign book drinking game, what should be on the list?
Oh my God. sorry. That is such a great question.
I'll throw up my mind to buy you some time.
Yeah.
Feel free to swat this down. It seems to me like in a lot of the male presidential candidates really go overboard saying how far they married over their head, they outkick their coverage, all of that sort of false modesty from the world's most raging egomaniacs.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, Joe Lieberman just passed away, and the one clip that everyone's been showing is Lieberman saying, behind every successful man, there's a surprised mother-in-law, which was hilarious. But it sort of fits in that mold. I'll tell you the thing that I always focus on in these campaign books is their acknowledgments. It's a wonderful source of back scratching, grudge holding, debts, both real and political and intellectual debts. They show you a lot. One of my favorite acknowledgments moments in a campaign book was in Marco Rubio's book, American Dreams, 2015 or so, when he was in that very crowded Republican field for the nomination that Trump ended up winning. You're right. They all talk about how they married well above their station, how their wives are the real brains of the operation. But in Rubio's case, he did thank his family like everyone else did. But he starts off, the first two people he thanks by name, I think, are very telling. He starts off thanking his Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Without his sacrifice, he wouldn't enjoy eternal life, et cetera, right? Which is fine. That's another sort of thing, like beating your chest about religion is required in campaign books. But then the next person he thanks is my very wise lawyer, Bob Barnett, right? And that's one of my favorite moments in any of these campaign books, because just especially having it back to back like that, because it just beautifully captures the inside outside game, right? The politicians are,
Sacred and profane.
yeah, your words. I wouldn't call having a power lawyer profane, but it's certainly not sacred. And that was just a great distillation of that. You also see their insecurities, right? Like Scott Walker, he thanks the commanders of the Wisconsin, National Guard. It's been an honor to be your commander in chief, right? Because it's hard for Midwestern governors to strut their, national security credentials. And so they emphasize stuff like that. They're like, well, I commanded the men and women of the National Guard. I often look at those. But what's interesting to me is that a lot of the writers, I mean, a lot of they're rarely the writers. These are often ghostwritten books. They often acknowledge how pro forma, how dutiful the exercise is. Lindsey Graham may have done the most, like, I don't want to write this version of a campaign book. In that same campaign cycle. And he even starts off saying, like, when you're looking for a big promotion in politics, people expect you to do something like this. So here it is, like just like completely uninterested in the exercise. George H.W. Bush wrote one. They all have very generic titles. I think Bush's was called Looking Forward or something like that. And even he says, like this is something you're sort of expected to do. They kind of admit it. They admit that it's just kind of this very dutiful exercise, and they're just trying to get it over with as quickly as possible.
Yeah, they all have titles like Courage to Stand or Leading to Fight, Fighting to Lead. Is
Yeah.
there a memorable title that stuck in your head that seemed a little over the top?
They all really blur together. The Truths We Hold, which I think was Kamala Harris's book, Promises to Keep, right, which was Joe Biden's book. I mean, weirdly, the more distant a political book is from that politician's campaign or time in office, the better it is and the more creative the titles. Jimmy Carter's, he's written so many books, but he's written about maybe four or five kind of straight up memoir type, autobiography type books. I think the title of his White House memoir was something like Keeping Faith. But really, his best book among the kind of memoristic books that he wrote is called An Hour Before Daylight, which is his book about growing up on his dad's farm in the Depression era in Georgia. And it's a beautiful book. It's an evocative title. That's when I think when the foreman of the farm would start things going. It was an hour before daylight. I count that as a Washington book in the sense that it's by a former president, but it's not really. It's revelatory of a former president, even if it's not revelatory of a presidency. And those tend to be much better.
And one of the cool things about your book, The Washington Book, it's a great survey of so many things that matter now, not just the political writings, Obama, Trump, Clinton, Biden, but expanding out to the Stacey Abrams, 1619, Dobbs decision verdict. You cover a lot in a few hundred pages. But what are the corridors of power in Washington that you think are undercovered, underwritten about? The presidency probably is appropriately covered or maybe overcovered in some ways. There's probably over-indexing of campaign books, a lot of the process books, but what do you think there should be more books about if we were to truly understand the way government works, Washington operates?
Money in politics, lobbying, the weeds of the policy process. These are less sexy subjects, but I think are vital. I'm as much to blame. Like I should, read and write about a lot more of those kinds of books. And then I have my own blind spots, right? Like at the Post, I was the national security editor. I was the economics editor. I edited our White House team for a spell during the last days of the George W. Bush presidency, when no one cared about the George W. Bush presidency anymore. Just everyone was writing about the 08 campaign. But I've never sort of edited or covered Congress in a significant way. That's something I need to know more about. And even when it comes to the Washington, sort of the Washington specific genre, the impact of think tanks and activist groups is important and sometimes undercovered, except in big significant moments when like the American Enterprise Institute wielded influence over Iraq war policy or the surge. There's moments when that becomes then embedded in books about those debates. But on an ongoing basis, I think that they matter a lot. Michael Schaefer at Politico, he's a columnist there, does a really good job covering the world of Washington that maybe we don't focus on as much as we should.
And maybe this is too similar a question, but in the 70s or maybe 80s, Bob Woodward broke major ground writing an expose chronicle of the Supreme Court of the late 60s and into the mid 70s, a book titled The Brethren, a nickname of the court before the days of Sandra Day O'Connor, Sotomayor, among others. But the idea being at the time, the court had been heretofore impenetrable, and Woodward was able to break the seal, get the inside scoop on the inner workings of this mysterious body. Are there other institutions in DC, other bodies, other groups, echelons of power, governmental power that just haven't been cracked or only rarely so?
I think the court's a great example. If you want to have fun, go back and read the reviews of The Brethren when it came out, especially this intense back and forth in the New York Review of Books about The Brethren. And you see sort of how people responded to the way the court was treated as just kind of one more political institution in that book. I recently read Joan Biskupic's new book on the court called Nine Black Robes, and it sort of echoed the Brethren in interesting ways for me. So I ended up writing about them together. And that's one of the essays in the Washington book. I think the Federal Reserve is another one. Every once in a while, you get a sort of expose, Secrets of the Temple type expose. Woodward himself wrote about Greenspan. But it's still a very complicated, murky institution that I think merits a lot more attention. Just the agency level, right? Like agency level Washington. There's so many people sort of chasing the White House coverage, chasing congressional coverage, but just like good old-fashioned beat writing on particular government agencies. It's still done, but I think it sort of matters enormously. There can never be enough of that. It's kind of like local politics, like nothing's more corrupt than politics at the local level. And that kind of coverage is drying up. You often have just a few reporters covering the state house and the legislature and all sorts of minutiae of state and local politics. And that's where a lot of stuff goes down. I would say that kind of agency level Washington beat reporting is something that I'd love to sort of dig into more and be able to read about more.
About as it relates to the military, that's something that doesn't get lumped in as readily to the Washington book cliches. Do you view that as a separate lane? I don't know. How do you think about where, the military, the Pentagon relates to the Washington book? Is it a different branch? Is it altogether
No,
separate?
I think it's vital. The State Department, the Treasury, the Pentagon, as sort of the pillars of the cabinet, political reporting, intelligence reporting, those are often very hard to crack. The best reporters who I've encountered covering those worlds have spent a lifetime covering those worlds, slowly building up sources over time. It's very hard to do. I mean, no disrespect to my own brethren in the political reporting world. I say that the barriers to entry to political reporting are not super high. Doing it well is hard, but a lot of people do it. It's harder to specialize in covering the intelligence agencies or covering the Pentagon. The single longest chapter in this book is about the books of 9/11. And there too, I mean, there's like hundreds, thousands of books that I could have looked at. I picked about 20 that I wanted to read or reread. And a lot of those deal with the intelligence agencies, or the military specifically. Those are feats of reporting. Those are very difficult lanes to crack. So I don't count them as separate from kind of the Washington book genre, but just in practice, they take a certain kind of writer and a certain kind of reporter. It's just different from covering campaign rallies and campaign fundraisers and campaign strategy. They all take sourcing, they all take a lot of work, but it's just a different kind of effort. And it's one that I respect enormously.
And is there work you can think of that when you're reading it and that you found among the most vindictive, the most committed to settling scores? Is there one or
Oh.
two that seems like it was purely an exercise in score settling?
Yes, and I don't have it in front of me, but like the moment you asked that question, the first thing I thought of was Sununu's memoir of his time as George H.W. Bush's chief of staff. I'm trying to remember exactly why that seemed to be like someone who the passage of time had not eased the grudges that he held. That comes to mind. But it's usually less subtle than that. It's not always I had this experience in Washington, therefore I'm going to tell you under my own name what went down and who was to blame. You get some of that. Like Stephanie Grisham was, I think, Trump's third press secretary. You could just tell like people she just hated. Like she just was like breathing fire for Mark Meadows, like stuff like that. Like all the Obama memoirs that come out, like you just see like there's people who were kind of like broadly disliked. But what you see more often is not, I'm going to write a score settling memoir under my own name. You see just the way that people become sources for other books, right? Especially for sort of, become sources for journalist books and kind of like launder their score settling in those ways instead. And, I say laundering as if, that were a crime. It's not like, journalists vet their sources and if people have things to say, they kind of like report around them and find out how credible those critiques are. It's telling for me, for instance, that a lot of the early books of the Trump presidency, for instance, seem to have Steve Bannon as a significant source. And a lot of the later books about the Trump presidency seem to have Mark Milley as a significant source. That tells you something, right? That tells you something both about the tenor of the books, the kind of stories the journalists were looking for, the shifting perceptions of the Trump presidency. And so I see kind of the score settling is often happening in those kind of less overt ways.
And you've gone deep on the topic of Donald Trump. You mentioned reading, analyze, writing, what, 150 some odd books. You are something of a Trump scholar. What do you think is different about the Trump of 2024 that we're seeing now than the Trump of 2015, 2016, when he emerged as a political figure?
I read recently both the Peter Baker Susan Glasser book, The Divider, about the Trump presidency, and the Maggie Haberman book, Confidence Man, about the Trump presidency and Trump more broadly. And I was struck by, and I wrote about this, I didn't see anybody else kind of pick up on this. If anyone kind of read both those books so closely, I mean, they were both massive bestsellers, so I know a lot of people must have read both those books, but I was struck by how in different moments, both books use the same metaphor to describe Trump's evolution in the presidency. And they both compared him to the Velociraptor from the first Jurassic Park movie when, remember, it learns to open the door, right? It was funny because they both like quoted different people in different contexts comparing Trump to the Jurassic Park Velociraptor. The implication was that Trump learned throughout his presidency. He learned to manipulate the levers of power. He was unable or not sufficiently knowledgeable to do that effectively early on. He also still felt early on in that presidency, he felt like he had to have the sort of more traditional, conventional Republican cabinet members and top aides who in some ways didn't let him kind of be fully unleashed, right? Who tried to constrain him in different ways. I think of that as the main difference. Now you have a candidate who feels like he knows how to use and abuse the federal government and who will surround himself with people who are more likely to be loyalists and to salute than with people who might try to steal a document off his desk, right? As was chronicled in one of the Woodward books on the Trump era. In some sense, Trump himself may not be super different. The enabling environment around him will be very different. And his kind of self-confidence at how he can use the executive branch, how he can use the powers of the office will be far greater. There was one book that was very helpful for me in this regard called Unmaking the Presidency by Susan Hennessy and Ben Wittes. It looked at kind of all these norms of presidential behavior. Like that was one of the big words of the Trump presidency was, you know, turns out we're a nation of norms as much as a nation of laws, and you know, he's busting all these norms. They looked at where the norms of presidential behavior, where they came from, how they built up around the presidency, and what it meant for them to erode. And that book, even though it came out probably midway through that Trump term, was very useful in understanding how a president can use his power up to the hilt, right? To the very extent of it. That's the difference. The difference is Trump is both confident, the sort of weird confidence of a kind of semi-incumbent.
Are there the great Washington books that never were? What would you have loved to have read that's just never been written?
Oh, wow. I kind of have tried to imagine those myself sometimes. Like George H.W. Bush never wrote a real memoir. He wrote a kind of like faux campaign memoir that was ghostwritten for him. He published a book of letters, a foreign policy book with Brent Scowcroft. He published his diary from his time as the China envoy in the 70s, but he never wrote like a real memoir. He strikes me as an incredibly interesting figure. Served as at an incredibly vital moment. When he died, I read all those books and tried to imagine what his memoir could have been like. That essay is, I think it's actually the lead essay in the book. I do picture that sometimes. There are memoirs that it's rarely presidential memoirs. It's often like key staffers that I'm interested in. Like I want to read a memoir by Kirstjen Nielsen, right? She was Secretary of DHS at a moment when border policy and border security became such an incredibly contentious issue. She was written about extensively in other books about that issue. Julie Davis and Mike Scheer wrote a book called Border Wars that kind of covers her quite a bit. But I wanted to understand those debates and that issue from her point of view, because she seemed like a really kind of beleaguered, beaten down high official who both was getting blamed for everything, yelled at in restaurants around Washington, and at the same time drove Trump crazy because she wouldn't like shut down the border or sort of do things that he wanted her to do. I think it might be in the Davis Scheer book. She's quoted as joking that if she ever wrote a memoir, it'd be called something like, "Just do it, honey," because that's something that like Trump would always say to her. It was something like that. So she's someone that I'd be interested in hearing from. Robert Mueller will probably never write a memoir. I don't know if he's interested or up for that kind of thing anymore at this stage in his life, but that would have been interesting to me, not just because of the Trump years, you know, a guy who became FBI director basically just on 9/11. You know, those are some of the books that I'd like to see exist, and a lot of books that exist that necessarily don't have to, but those are some that I would like to see.
That's probably a much longer list of the unnecessary books. And I should say in your book, it's not only American authors. You are able to glean something about Vladimir Putin that you write about. Can you speak to your thoughts there?
Yeah, I only thought about doing that when the war in Ukraine began. I called a few people who are Putin experts, asked like what kind of publications he had, what kind of essays he'd written. And I also just, this sounds so absurd, I just went on Amazon. And that's how I realized that he had done a sort of an interviewed memoir. Some journalists had interviewed him and had published it just as he was taking power in Russia, 99, 2000. I decided to read the Putin canon. I reached out to Fiona Hill, who had written a book about Putin, and she was very helpful in telling me what was worth reading. He's someone who fancies himself something of a writer, of an essayist, of a big thinker. And so there were plenty of essays that he had written over the years. One thing that struck me about Putin, and that actually seemed very instructive for the ongoing war, the way he thought about the end of the Soviet Union. We've all heard that he has said that it was this great, geopolitical catastrophe, et cetera. But something else that I thought was illuminating is that he said that what had happened essentially was not all these big systemic forces and the exhaustion of the Soviet model. No, he said that basically the Soviets blinked. The Soviets lost their nerve and Washington took advantage and rewrote the rules of a new era. And he called it the paralysis of power. He said that, look, Soviet Union had all this power, and really they just had to wield it, and they didn't. And for him, that key moment is that, he was a KGB officer in Dresden when the wall is coming down. He worries they're coming after him. He's trying to reach Moscow, and Moscow was silent. They gave him no instruction. And that to him captured the paralysis of power. That was something he wrote, or that appears in an interview in that 2000 book, which is called First Person. And then suddenly, you're hearing the speeches he's giving in February of 2022 about Ukraine. And once again, he's talking about the paralysis of power. 20 plus years later, this is still a notion that is in his head. It seemed clear from his speeches that, as much as he felt that, yes, he says that Ukraine's not a real country and it just needs to be part of greater Russia and all this, so much of it was still this anger at like the cocky, undeserving winners of the Cold War. Sticking it to them was as much an animating impulse behind what he's doing as any of these kind of like historic, ethnic, political rationalizations. I said like how just a few things kind of stay with me sometimes over time. Like for me, that idea, right? The notion that power must always be wielded, it can't be static, right? That it's useless if you don't use it. That's what I learned about by like rereading Vladimir Putin.
It's not your official job title, but you're an essayist, right? In a lot of ways, this book is a collection of essays, your reviews, your pieces for the New York Times. How do you approach writing an essay? In the professional world, you realize that the challenge is it's much harder to write the really smart, sharp, actionable one-page memo than it is the 30-page dossier where you can just throw everything against the wall. So, what can you impart about the art of punchy, smart, relatively short writing?
A couple of things. First, know your material really, really, really well. Like when I'm writing about a book, I read it three times. I keep culling a smaller and smaller subset of kind of vital points and ideas and questions and quotes that I have. And then I kind of put those all into their own file, and that becomes my raw material for whatever I'm writing about. And authors may not agree with my conclusions about their books, but I don't think they can say that I didn't fully absorb them and take them seriously. The other thing, I taught political journalism for several years, college class for Notre Dame, my alma mater. The thing I would tell writing students is constant rewriting, constant reading of your work out loud. When you think you have a draft, always read it out loud. That's when I find terrible run-on sentences, repetitive ideas, things that just don't make sense, that don't come to you when you're reading them on a page, but when you're saying them out loud, even worse, saying them out loud to another human, that's a hard thing. Caro would always say, or I think in that book he recently published about his own process, he said that he would often decide what the final sentence of his book was going to be. And then the whole process of writing was like, how do I get to that final sentence? And that's why the final sentence in The Power Broker is someone talking about Robert Moses saying, like, why weren't they grateful? Right? Which is such an amazing moment. And the whole effort of writing that book was kind of getting to that last line. I would never compare myself to Robert Caro, but I have taken that to heart. To kind of know where you want to end then forces you to figure out what are your way stations along the way to that destination. Some people just end up writing, just start writing, kind of hoping they're going to get somewhere. And that's a recipe for a lot of frustration. So to both enter the reading process with an open mind or the reporting process with an open mind, but then once you've absorbed all that, to kind of know where you want to end up. That's how it works for me. I obviously can't sort of write one of these pieces in a single sitting. So another thing I do is, this is like way in the weeds of process. When I come back to a piece that I'm like halfway through, I never just start writing where I left off. I always have to meticulously start re-editing, rereading, rewriting, like everything that led to that moment. So if you go through several drafts, you know, as you should, there's nothing more effortless than that eighth draft, right? If you go through several drafts, then that means you've rewritten the top of your piece dozens of times. Also, finally, just embrace the quality of doneness. You can always make it better. You can kill yourself tweaking forever. And at some point, you just have to hand it over. I hate reading things after I've written them because I always find ways that they could have been smarter, better, more interesting. But of course, I won't share those with you here. but I would say those are some of the key elements. You know, the whole, like, you know, murder your darlings thing is real. The notion that, you know, you can fall in love with little jokes or little lines, but more than being willing to jettison those, I think it's also being willing to jettison particular ideas sometimes. Like, a piece can only really be about one or two things, no matter how long it is. Trying to jam too much into it, just isn't worth it. Save it. There's always another thing to write. At my desk, I have a lot of little post-it notes for ideas, even phrases I want to use. And I have no idea in what context I will use them or when they'll come up. I'll just share one. I shouldn't share them because I want to use them in the future. But, like, there's something I want to say about a writer, you know, that so-and-so is the voice of a generation, just not of his own. And I don't know who that's going to apply to, but it will someday. And I'm saving it until then. Walk around with a notebook wherever you are. Because ideas come to you in weird moments, and then they slip away, and they're never going to come back unless you write them down.
Let me end on this. You were the editor of the Washington Post Outlook section for a spell, a section that closed up a couple of years ago, but at its heyday was a clearinghouse for a lot of important writing and writers. What can you impart about the Washington Post Outlook section at its best?
Oh gosh, Outlook was probably the most fun I've ever had. As a journalist, the 5 years that I was the Outlook editor at the Post, you're scratching a real itch here. And at the Post, it was a home for, over the decades, for really creative and ambitious work. David Ignatius ran the Post Outlook section. Bob Kaiser ran the Post Outlook section. Jody Allen, Steve Luxenberg, Susan Glasser, John Pomfret, Adam Kushner, who now has joined me here at the Times, Kate Boo wrote for the Post Outlook section, was an editor there as well. It was, to my mind, a real jewel in the kind of Washington Post lineup, and it became the kind of section that a lot of other places began to emulate. My favorite thing as an editor there was when I could publish pieces that would become important books later on, which I was very proud of, or when I could take books that were coming and that may not have gotten a ton of attention, but through some very sort of targeted excerpt, often which was not just like publishing an introduction or a random chapter, but, you know, really stitching something together from throughout the book, could bring attention to work that deserved it. I'll give you two examples of that. Carol Anderson wrote a book during the Ferguson protests that became her book, White Rage, which I thought was a significant book. I believe it won the National Book Critics Circle Prize. And two longtime Washington figures, Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein, I worked with them to publish an excerpt of their book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, in which in 2012 raised very early alarms about not just kind of two-sided polarization, but what they called asymmetric polarization, that kind of one side of our political life was becoming more extreme than the other. And I remember one moment when I was talking to them about it, I said, yes, like that's what we should write about, except we will never use the term asymmetric polarization. And they understood. But, you know, those are two of many. The beauty of Outlook is that it was just a completely blank canvas every Sunday. And it could be anything. It could be politics, it could be culture, it could be first person essays, it could be anything the editors and the contributors could dream of. And it was my honor to be a deputy editor there, the editor, and then a critic based in Outlook for a total of 12 years, which was most of my time at the Post. So it was great. I still miss it. But, you know, things change. Editors make decisions. Sections come and go. But this one lasted a good long time, and I think it earned every Sunday.
Book is the Washington Book, a great compendium of essays about the politics of the last several years with smart insight as to what it means for the future. Not just a smart read, but a lot of fun and entertaining as well. The author, Carlos Lozada. Thanks for making time for me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Pro Politics Podcast. Please subscribe so you can access each episode first thing every Tuesday morning. And if you're so inclined, leave a rating and a short review on your podcast app to help more people find this podcast. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook for updates on upcoming guests. Thanks for listening.